Здравствуйте, дорогие юные друзья.
Экономика должна быть экономной.
Товарищи, победа.
Честь и слава советскому.
Ближе надо.
Скоропостижно скончался Леонид Ильич Брежнев.
Можно начинать?
One can argue, and indeed I have argued, that the current epoch of Russian history began 30 years ago this weekend. On the morning of November 10, 1982, Leonid Brezhnev died after ruling the Soviet Union for 18 years. Brezhnev's passing was more than just the death of a long-serving leader. It represented a generational change of the guard. The so-called class of 1937, which rose to power in the wake of the Stalinist purges and ruled the country for decades, was on its way out. And the post-Stalin generation and its successors were on their way in. The aftershocks of this generational earthquake would ultimately bring down the Soviet Union. And ever since this passing of the torch, Brezhnev's successors in the Kremlin, from Yuri Andropov to Mikhail Gorbachev, from Boris Yeltsin to Vladimir Putin, have struggled with a dilemma. How to reform and modernize Russia without losing power in the process. The lexicon has changed, from Andropov's discipline campaign to Gorbachev's perestroika to Dmitry Medvedev's ill-fated modernizatsiya. But the essential problem has remained the same. 3 decades after Brezhnev, Russians quite literally live in a different country. But the Kremlin is still struggling with the same old riddle. Hello, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service. Welcome, Kirill.
Hello.
Kirill, I noted on the blog, first of all, welcome back from your trip to Siberia.
Happy to be here.
We'll talk more about that in the second half of the show. I wrote on the blog this week that the coalition of KGB hardliners and liberal technocrats that chose both Andropov and Gorbachev as Soviet leaders in the 1980s, also teamed up, or at least their bureaucratic successors teamed up, to put Putin in the Kremlin at the turn of the millennium. As Mark Galeotti pointed out last week on the podcast, it was essentially the same coalition. And this, I believe, is very telling. Andropovism, with its focus on discipline, and Gorbachevism, for lack of a better word, with its focus on structural reform, represent the two main conceptions of post-Brezhnev reform in Russia, and both eventually lead to a dead end. We saw this in August 1991 when, faced with the full implications of Gorbachevism, the Siloviki rebelled and staged a coup. And we're seeing it today with Putin, as the technocratic wing of the elite is rebelling against Putin's hardline Andropov-style rule. Do you see this post-Brezhnev deadlock being broken up in any way, or is it just a permanent feature of Russian politics?
I just listened to Brezhnev voices, and of course, first reaction of mine, it was very lyrical. You know, I spent all my childhood and teenage during his reign.
Where were you when he died? How did you learn of his death?
Oh, I remember this day very, very, very well. I was on the second course of the universe. I studied as a historian on historical department. And it was November the 10th. We came to, you know, to some kind of lecture. It was very dull lecture. Some, you know, kind of propaganda subject scientific communism or something like this. So we were half asleep, all of us. And then suddenly someone came in and told that something happened. No one understood what's happened. Because, you know, when you live all your life during the reign or rule of one leader, because I was born two months before Brezhnev's rise to power, and I was, 18 mm-hmm. and half when he died. So I spent all my life during Brezhnev's rule. Mm-hmm. For me, it was like, Elvis Presley for Americans. Right. He's always alive.
Right, we're roughly the same age, but I lived through, let's see, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, six presidents by that time.
Happy you. But I didn't need to learn all these names by heart. So it was very simple to know just Brezhnev all the time. And his second name, Leonid Ilyich Brezhnev, was like Vladimir Ilyich Lenin.
Right.
So it was absolutely the same. So Lenin Ilyich, Brezhnev Ilyich, our dear Ilyich, мой дорогой Ilyich, it was at the same time about Lenin and about Brezhnev. Right. So let's return to serious things. Yeah. First of all, I think that we have to handle this problem historically. Mm-hmm. Of course, we can speak about some kind of union of siloviki and liberals. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, if we speak about the end of Brezhnev rules, if we speak about, the Andropov times, mm-hmm. and in some sense the beginning of the Gorbachev era, in some sense, by the way, in the beginning of Yeltsin's rule, because, I'm very respectful for all these people who defend democracy during August Putsch, but some Siloviki was on Yeltsin's side.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to remember this. It was also some kind of, union between...
Oh, sure, and there were some technocrats that were on the other side.
Yeah.
But the point I tried to make in the blog this week, and I talked about a little bit in my opening monologue, was that there was this post-Brezhnev consensus that reform was necessary.
Mm-hmm.
The status quo was unacceptable, and that something had to change. And the two sides of the elite that saw this... And we've discussed this off mic a lot. The KGB saw it more clearly than anybody because they had to see it, because they were the only ones with the real information. And the technocratic, or for lack of a better term, what passed as liberals in the Soviet bureaucracy, this technocratic side of the elite, these two agreed that something had to be done. Something
Absolutely.
Had to change. But they didn't agree on what, and they've gone, they teamed up and backed Andropov, whose idea of reform was tightening the screws, more discipline, authoritarian modernization, what we would call today the Chinese model. And they also teamed up to elect Gorbachev inside the party, whose idea of reform was a little bit more comprehensive, a little bit more dealing with structural reforms, introducing market mechanisms to the economy, introducing eventually political reforms. And my point is that once either of these two variants gets pushed to its logical conclusion, one side or the other is going to rebel. Okay, when Gorbachevism was pushed to its limits, the Siloviki of the time, the hardliners, the KGB, rebelled and staged the August coup of 91 that eventually brought down the Soviet Union. Now, where we say Putin, and I believe Putin's rule is very much modeled on Andropov's, now you're seeing the technocratic side of the elite, today's technocratic side of the elite, rebelling. So these two constituencies unite agree that the system needs to be reformed.
Something
and the problem is the same. Russia's economy is dependent on commodities. It's dependent on oil exports. It's not modernized enough. It's not flexible enough. It's not diverse enough. And that something has to be done. Now, if you push a economic diversification model to its logical conclusion, it's going to create a decentralization of the economy away from the energy sector. It's going to create alternative centers of power. That's unacceptable to people on the Siloviki side. So you have this paradox, and we've seen it play out a couple of times now. We've seen, all right, if you want to go through Andropov, Gorbachev, Yeltsin, right? Then the same coalition came together to elect Putin, which went back to a more of an Andropov-style rule. I mean, you could say the two post-Soviet leaders mirrored the last two, if you exclude Chernyanko, who doesn't really count, the last two Soviet leaders. Putin mirrored Andropov's style, and Yeltsin mirrored a bit of Gorbachev's style, whether he likes it or not, in terms of following the path of democratization and reform. And you could say Medvedev almost felt like a Gorbachev redux. It just seems like it seems to be going back and forth between these two different models, and they all had their birth in the post-Brezhnev period. That's...
I agree with you, but we have to, you know, focus on the most important, you know, term or word in this idea, in this concept. For me, the main word here is knowledge. Who has knowledge about the situation in the country, or who had this knowledge about the situation in Soviet Union?
In Soviet times, the KGB had the most knowledge.
KGB. That's why they were very, you know, worried about the situation and were thinking about how to change the situation. Mm-hmm. The main word is knowledge. It's not because, you know, the members of the Central Committee of CPSU was so stupid and so on, but the Soviet system itself had been built, you know, in the same construction or such construction that the only part of the elite who can obtain this knowledge was KGB. Yeah. Not ideological, you know, right. Leaders and so on. Ideological leaders were all about the ideology. Mm-hmm. Administrative leaders were all about, you know, administrative mm-hmm. problems mm-hmm. and how to build the state and how to maintain the state and so on. The only one body of the Soviet Union, you know, state was KGB, who had all this knowledge in the...
And knew how far behind the West.
Yes. Yes.
Today, everybody has this
yes.
knowledge.
Just a second. But the second question is what is the extent of understanding of this knowledge about the situation of the country? You know, now, today, everyone, or almost everyone in Russia can understand that something you know, is going wrong in the country, in the economy, in the social mm-hmm. sphere, and so on. The knowledge is almost the same for all the, you yeah. know, political thinkers, politicians, you know, journalists, and public leaders, and so on. But the outcome of this knowledge, the result of this, you know, way of thinking is absolutely different. Absolutely different. So the question is not what do we know now. The question is what to do with this situation. And if we compare this today's situation with the one of, you know, the end of Brezhnev rule and so on, I think the only answer... I'm very sorry, but the only answer was to, you know, to make some reforms in the limits of the Soviet state and Soviet ideology, because we cannot take, you know, leaders of Soviet KGB as dissidents. They were not dissidents. They were very pragmatic.
No, they wanted to preserve
yes.
the existing system.
Yes, but the very limits of the states was, you know, very, very strange. You know everything within these limits. You think, you know, rightly about what to do, how to do, and so on. But the result is ridiculous.
Right.
That was the problem with Andropov. He was a very serious man, very serious leader, and so on. But I remember his rule all this, you know, 1 year and a half when he was leader of Soviet Union. It was the most ridiculous period in Soviet history that I can remember. Even Konstantin Chernenko, who was very old, very sick, and so on, we even, you know, didn't mention him, notice right. him during the time of his rule, but it was okay. Because we used to live our own life, and the state lived within its, you know, limits and so on. But Andropov tried to cross these limits.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very ridiculous because he was not Stalin. This was not, you know, dangerous for us. We didn't afraid of this crossing the lines by the state. It was just ridiculous. All his attempts to, you know, to stop corruption, to, you know, all his measures against alcoholism, you know, all these discipline mm-hmm. measures and so on, they... in the end, there was absolutely, you know, everyone was laughing on these things. So that was, I think, that was the real agony of Soviet Union. Not Chernenko, not Gorbachev, but Andropov, because this period showed that reforms are impossible in the Soviet Union.
Inside that system. Yes. And now what we're seeing, wasn't just the Soviet system, because again, we're having the same, and I don't think we're in a period analogous to the period after the death of Brezhnev. That's not what I would argue. What I would argue is that there hasn't been a post-Brezhnev consensus formed in the elite or in society. There's been this understanding since the death of Brezhnev that the system needs to be reformed, that the economy needs to be modernized and diversified, but there's not been a consensus about what to do. We've had these two mutually exclusive, really, conceptions of what to do. And again, I mean, I would almost argue if you say what happened in September of last year when Putin returned to the presidency, it's very analogous to the coup of August 1991, except it was successful. In other words, I do consider the Medvedev period as an attempt at a Gorbachev redux.
Yes, but...
But it was unacceptable to the Siloviki, yes. And they made sure it didn't go anywhere. Why is it that throughout, I mean, basically over the course of two countries, the Soviet Union and the Russian Federation, we have been unable to come to a post-Brezhnev consensus about how to reform the system? What's holding this back? Is it bureaucratic inertia? Is it the strength of the Siloviki? What is it?
Of course, it's a great temptation to speak about, you know, the eternal game of Russian history and the struggle between the liberals and Siloviki.
I'm just talking about 30 years. I'm not getting into the eternal game.
yes, but we can remember, you know, about the Pavel the First reign, or about the Alexander the First reign, or about the Nicholas the First reign, and whatever, and so on. But I think the answer is that we have to focus on historically on the term liberals, mm-hmm. because when we speak about liberals in late Brezhnev times and liberals today, they are absolutely different groups. Mm-hmm. Liberals during the beginning of 80s, they were weak and soft social democrats.
Mm-hmm.
Liberals today in Russian elite and so on, they are neoliberals.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely opposite. Liberals in the beginning of 1980s, they were all about, you know, some civil rights, you know, very soft, very mild and so on, but about all this, you know, agenda of Western 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And today's liberals, they are in some sense just on the right of political spectrum. You know, in American terms, they're near, Mitt Romney, not Barack Obama.
No, but well, in the Soviet system, it was impossible to be in that, to be inside the Soviet system, to be that far right.
The second thing, which is very interesting, so-called Chekiste, the KGB members, leadership and so on, in the very beginning of 1980s, it was, they tried to, in some sense, they tried to revive their ideals of Soviet 1920s.
Mm.
You know, not 1930s, not Stalin times, mm-hmm. but 1920s.
So NEP.
NEP, and in some sense, a pure ideological, the sense of social equality, in some sense. They were against a Soviet corrupted system of late Brezhnev because it was corrupted Soviet system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were all about the purity. That was the, the subject of this struggle between KGB, and the inner circle of Brezhnev's inner circle, including Sholokhov and so on. That was the main problem of the struggle. They struggled, the KGB leaders and so on, they struggled against Brezhnev elite or Brezhnev circle and so on, because they were not pure communists.
Mm-hmm.
But today, KGB or FSB and so on, Siloviki so-called, they're such far away from all these communist ideals.
Of course,
and so
yeah, because there's no ruling ideology.
So the output of all this, our talk, could be that today liberals, so-called liberals, Russian liberals, and so-called Siloviki, they have really much more in common than it was in the beginning of 1980s, because they, all of them, the both of them, they were on the same platform, ideological or pragmatic platform, because they are on the right of their normal, so-called normal political spectrum.
Today. Yeah. So you say there's more, there's
there
more.
Is a chance, I think, for them to, you know, to join the efforts and so on. The obstacle of this coalition today is a figure of Putin himself. Mm. He is the, I think, the most important obstacle to, future union of, for instance, Kudrin and whoever. Because Kudrin is neoliberal and he is all about financial property and so on, so on, so on. And all these FSB, leaders and so on, they are not just secret agents and so on. They are all about capitalism and mm-hmm. so on. So they have the same platform. And that is the answer why opposition is moving on the left. Mm-hmm. Because they instinctively, subconsciously, they understand that their enemy is on the right. Mm. And I think that is a chance, a very good chance for the beginning of real politics in Russia, in the Western terms, mm-hmm. because that is the real division between left and right, between, haves and have-nots, mm-hmm. mm-hmm. and so on.
In a few moments, we'll shift the discussion a bit and talk about Kirill's recent trip to Siberia and what he can tell us about how things look on the ground. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me is my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at RFERL.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical.
До Магадана несколько скорее.
As regular listeners know by now, Kirill just got back from a trip to Russia that took him not just to Moscow, but all the way to Siberia. Kirill, I know you go back regularly, but is there anything particularly telling you saw on this trip that gives us an idea of how things are going in Russia?
I visit Siberia once a year. Every autumn, in the end of October and the beginning, very beginning of November, in the middle of 2000s, I visited Norilsk. It's, I think, the most far north town or city in the world. But now I know about one, about another town. It's in Norway, Kirkenes. And I'm going there, by the way, in the beginning of December.
I'm glutton for punishment.
Yeah. So... and then, after several years in Norilsk, visiting Norilsk, I began to visit Krasnoyarsk at the same time because of international Krasnoyarsk International Book Fair. Mm-hmm. Usually, it takes place in the very end, as I told you, the very end of October, the very beginning of November. So, of course, my experience of Siberia and my experience of the cities, Norilsk and Krasnoyarsk, is in some sense, limited. Mm-hmm. Yes, as a guest of a book fair, as a guest, or as a visiting lecturer, as I visited Krasnoyarsk once to local university, or mm-hmm. the participant of, some conference on mm-hmm. the problem of the far north areas and so on. But something I can see. Mm. And I saw something, and I noticed something, and I'm still noticing something and still thinking about this. First of all, I am not very original in this idea, but Siberia is absolutely different to Central Russia. So we have, I don't know, I never been to far Russian Far East, but there are two Russias absolutely. On the one side of Ural Mountains and on the other side of Ural Mountains. Central Russia is all about, its ties with Moscow. Mm-hmm. It's connected to Moscow. It's all the thoughts about of the population of the city. It doesn't matter. It could be my native Nizhny Novgorod, or it could be Arkhangelsk, it could be even St. Petersburg, which is quite different from Moscow and opposing Moscow.
But it's very connected to Moscow.
Yes, it's very connected by the hate, envy, and so on. In Siberia, Moscow, I'm very sorry for Moscovites, but in Siberia, Moscow doesn't exist at all.
Doesn't exist politically, doesn't exist culturally.
Culturally, politically, and even, in public consciousness at all. They think about their own region. And by the way, Krasnoyarsky region is the richest region in Russia, excluding Moscow. Sure.
It's oil rich. And that
it's oil, gas, aluminum, nickel, whatever. And it longs from the very north, from the north icy ocean, Severny Ledovitый Океан, to the on the south to the border with Kazakhstan. So it's a huge territory, yes, and it's cutting Russian territory. If you look at the map, into two parts. Not Urals, but Krasnoyarsky region. Right. It's very interesting. So when you arrive in Norilsk or Krasnoyarsk, and then you go out to the airport building and you see so-called marshrutki, it's a small buses, and usually they are private, and you see this is a small bus to Novosibirsk. Can you imagine the how many kilometers between Krasnoyarsk and Novosibirsk? Right. So I think something about 600 or 700.
Right. Yeah. At least
it's, in European terms, it's just not another country. It's just another continent and so on. But for the inhabitants of Siberia, it's in some sense it's the same. We all live in Siberia, they think. Not we all live in Russia. It's not about separatism. No, they consider themselves as Russians and the, Siberians, at the same time. And for me, it's very, optimistic idea, because Russian history was all about, this centralized state and all about state, not about society. From the Ivan the Terrible to Peter the Great and so on, all the reforms, everything that happened was happening in Russian history was happening in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and in some sense in Nizhny Novgorod, but not in any other regions and so on. Now it's absolutely different. Now Siberia has its own politics, it has its own economy, and has its own public consciousness.
Do you see any trends there that could influence the larger dynamic in Russia?
I cannot find any traces of a political agenda which is common for all central Russian, territories, and especially Moscow. Okay, I cannot find any traces of Moscow political agenda in Krasnoyarsk. No any words about, Navalny, what else, Russian March, and so on and so on. But local politics in Krasnoyarsk is very, very strong, and there are a lot of local leaders. Of course, they're formally they're members of United Russia or some other political parties. But even United Russia in Krasnoyarsk or in Siberia is not United Russia as we know it's, in Moscow, St. Petersburg, or some other central Russian regions. And so, it's half local party with prevailing local interests. First of all, of course, economical interests. All, as I understand, of course, my experience is very limited. But as I understand, all local politics is all about economy. That is a pure example of, I think, in my sense, in my opinion, of the, right direction of development of Russian society and Russian politics. Maybe I am a little bit romantic about Siberia and so on.
Maybe Siberia is the California of Russia.
We see trends
that are going to go across America. Yes. They tend to start in California often. Is Siberia perhaps the very cold, take California's climate any time over Siberia's? But
In the terms of climate, if anti-California.
I mean, this is not new. But remember the Novosibirsk report, which became one of the inspirations for Perestroika. Actually, came out of Novosibirsk. So
yeah, but it's very interesting that they in Siberia, in large cities, in Krasnoyarsk, Novosibirsk, Tomsk, they in some sense they have same political or cultural trends, but they are at the same time very local.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just about atmosphere, local atmosphere of the central political trends. No, they are somehow, I don't know how, they are at the same time Moscow or central and at the same time local. That is my first idea about this. And second, of course, we'll discuss all these things next time, maybe, or after my next visit to Siberia. Of course, the image of Krasnoyarsk, for me, it's an image of American city.
Mm.
A very wide highways, a lot of shopping malls, and no sidewalks at all in the new districts.
And this is new. This is not. New. This was not the case before.
Yes, yes. And all local people, they have cars, and the most interesting for them entertainment is to go on the weekend to shopping mall with the family, to have dinner at some kind of KFC or something like this, and then cinema, and then some shopping. So it's not bad. It's a normal way of modern urban American life. Don't forget about this. 50 or 60 years ago, Siberia was a part of the world where Gulag was situated.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great shift. I think I look at all these things very optimistically.
So you look at you. It's good to see you optimistic about something. So
yes, I'm a Siberian patriot.
A Siberian patriot from Nizhny Novgorod.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that's all we have time for today. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFERL. In the studio with me has been my regular co-host, Kirill Kobrin of RFERL's Russian service. Thanks for the great discussion,
Drew. Thank you.
I'd also like to thank our superb producer, Tanya Kancheva, and a special thanks to my indispensable colleague, Pavel Buturin, who found all that cool Brezhnev audio we had at the start of this podcast. And I'd also like to remind our listeners that Pavel's Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, simply rocks. And you can follow Pavel's great insights at Rus Police Watch. And a big thanks to Mark Galliotti and Sean Guillory for filling in while Kirill was off partying in Siberia. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes, you can read the Power Vertical blog at rfurl.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week, and now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.